Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The latest on the Sussman trial and the horror in Uvalde. You, of course, listening to a National View podcast. For some reason, you're not already following us on a streaming service. You can get us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
How are you, Rich?
Good, Andy. How are you?
I'm good. I'm still here in Chicago for one more week. A little gloomy today, but gloomier in the country, I'm afraid, than it is here.
Yeah, just terrible. We'll get to that after diving into the Sussman trial, which you've obviously been following in great detail, covering for us and for Fox. So how has this been going, and what are the big events this week?
Well, the biggest thing, Rich, is that Michael Sussman opted not to testify in his own defense. And I think that that was a sensible calculation on his part, because he obviously sees that things are going in his direction. It's a very ironic development and an ironic case, in the sense that I think what the proof has shown over 2 weeks is that he certainly lied to the FBI. But as more information has come out, what we've learned is that there's no doubt that the FBI knew exactly who he was, and the fact that they were getting political information, that is information from a partisan source who was, basically dumping dirt on the opposition candidate. And the most interesting testimony this week and other disclosures in the court have been about the fact that the FBI knew it was handling hyper-political information, and at the headquarters level seems to have tried to cover its tracks in order to conceal the fact that it knew it was dealing with politicized information.
So with that, so how would that affect whether Sussman committed a crime or not?
Well, I think the biggest thing, Rich, with respect to the FBI evidence, is it goes to the key question in any false statements case, which is materiality. Mm-hmm. So the two big elements you have to prove are falsity and materiality. Durham has an unexpected falsity problem, which I'll come to in due course. But to address the thing that you've asked about, which is the most important part, the materiality, what you really have to show is that that the lie that was told had an impact on the way that the agency handled the matter, and that mm-hmm. they would have handled it otherwise. So that's the materiality part of it. And then I think there's also the atmospheric part of it, and they're kind of hand in glove. But the bottom line is that Sussman is able to kind of look at the jury and say nothing that he did or said made any difference to the FBI, because, for example, even after they ran down this information of his, they had the line agents run down the information. When it turned out that there was nothing to this allegation, the paper trail says that the top tier of the FBI directed that it be investigated anyway, that the fact that they couldn't find a crime didn't make any difference to them, because they said, all right, well, then just open it as a counterintelligence investigation, but we're not shutting this down. And one of the case agents on Crossfire Hurricane, which is famously the code name that the FBI gave the Trump-Russia investigation, tells the agents in Chicago, look, the seventh floor is very hyped up about this, to include the director, and that meaning Director Jim Comey. The seventh floor is the executive suite of offices of the top officials at the FBI at the J. Edgar Hoover building, which is their headquarters in Washington. And the Chicago agents were also told that the top counterintelligence agent, Bill Priestap, had directed that this be ordered as opened full-fledged as a counterintelligence investigation. And the agent said, the agent who passed that direction along to the counterintelligence guys in Chicago said that this is not an option, meaning it wasn't, what he meant was, this is not optional. We must do it. So in other words, they didn't care what the evidence showed. They were moving ahead with this no matter what. And the other problems that come out of this is, you remember we talked last week about how Sussman has this meeting with Jim Baker, who was then the general counsel of the FBI, and Baker takes the information. And I mentioned, I think last week, that Baker said that he decided to treat Sussman as a confidential informant rather than note that the information came from, Sussman himself. They kept that, as they say, on close hold. And what we had already started to learn last week was that this was a matter of no small amount of frustration and aggravation to the agents who were tasked to investigate the information that Sussman had brought, because they thought it was important to know what the source of the information was so that they can gauge the reliability of it and whether the Bureau was being played, et cetera. Once we got a look at the paper trail this week, Rich, it became pretty clear that the FBI didn't cover up Sussman's identity to protect Sussman. Sussman didn't ask to be treated as a confidential informant. There's no indication that his security was in any way threatened. And in fact, they wanted this information to be public. It wasn't like they were, trying to do something that they expected was going to be on a close hold. So it looks like what the headquarters people at the Bureau did was conceal his identity in order to protect the Bureau, meaning they knew that they were taking information from somebody who was a very suspect source, no matter what Baker said about believing Sussman's story that he was just there as a patriotic American who wanted to help the FBI. They concealed his identity from the investigating agents in Chicago, the cyber guys to whom this was assigned, because if they had said that it came from Sussman, it would have been obvious to those agents that it was political in nature. Everybody knew who Sussman was. Sussman had represented the Democratic National Committee in the hacking case a few months before this, and had in fact prevented the FBI from being able to examine the DNC servers. So, Sussman was a notable or notorious figure among FBI people. And if they had been open about what his name was, the agents investigating would have known the political nature of this. And in fact, they didn't even want to say that he was a confidential informant or a CI, because typically when you take information from a CI, even if you don't give up the name, you still have to put something in your reports that indicates why the CI is in a position to know the things that he's telling you. That's just standard operating procedure. It's common sense that you always want to know as an investigator where the information is coming from and whether the source seems to be reliable or not. And that leads, Rich, to the biggest embarrassment of the week, which is the Sussman defense made a big deal, and you could understand why they would, about the information opening document that is in the FBI's files. Whenever the FBI opens a full-blown investigation, it's accompanied by a document that is known as the EC, or electronic communication in the Bureau's patois. And in this instance, the EC says that this information came to the FBI not from Sussman, not even from a confidential informant, but from the United States Department of Justice, which is just absurd. Mm-hmm. And it was so embarrassing that two of the agents who were involved in the drafting of this thing were put on the stand and asked, how did you end up saying that this information came from the Justice Department? And they, let me just say, they didn't answer the question. I don't want to say that they couldn't answer the question. I think that as embarrassing as it was, probably being honest about how it got there would be even worse. But it just seems to me pretty obvious that they knew they were dealing with very political information. They wanted to conceal Sussman's identity. They didn't want to call him a confidential informant because you would still have to explain why the information might be reliable. So they ended up just putting down something that wasn't true. And it's not a good position. And of course, this isn't Durham's fault, but it's not a good position for prosecutors to be in when you're prosecuting a false statements case, to have the FBI making a false statement in the information opening document, you know? So it was pretty bad week as far as that all went for Durham's case.
So to just underline two points here. One, if I go to the FBI and I'm using an example that would suggest I'm crazy, but let's put the, I'm just telling a lie.
Not you, Rich.
So I go to the FBI and I want them to investigate fraud in my workshop. And I say, I'm Santa Claus. You know, I attest to you up and down, I'm Santa Claus. And I need you to start this investigation because someone's stealing toys out the back end, at the back door, you know, from me. And I want this investigated. If they have reason to believe I'm not Santa Claus, it doesn't matter that I've lied to the FBI and they don't do what I want them to do, or they were going to do it anyway. It doesn't matter what I told them, the lies that I told them.
Yeah. And I, you know, the way that this comes up, Rich, in a more natural setting is, you know, I sit down for a long interview with the FBI and I tell them reasonably accurately the thing that they're there to question me about. But when they ask me, you know, for my background information, like my date of birth and where I come from, I lie about my age, or I have some embarrassing thing in my background that doesn't have anything to do with the issue at hand, but I don't tell the truth about it. That's the kind of thing that's an immaterial lie, in the sense that if I had been honest about it, it wouldn't have changed the way that the FBI approached the case, as right. opposed to, say, a lie about the substance of the thing that they're there to investigate. So that's the way that it usually comes up. And a lot of this, as I say, is, you know, a question. It's a low bar, because you can pretty much always say when somebody lies to you about at least something that's not tangential to what you're there to question them about, you can always imagine the things that you might have done differently if you had gotten truthful information. And here, I don't think it's difficult to come up with that. I mean, obviously, Sussman gave them, we call this a lie. I've been calling it more a cover story, because I think that's more what it is here. But, you know, Sussman gave them a cover story that, you know, that he wasn't representing anyone. And in the abstract, if he had told them, you know, the whole reason to lie about that is because he knows that he's providing very political information in a very political context. This was 6 weeks before Election Day. They were hoping to get this big October surprise where the media was going to report that Trump was a Putin puppet and the FBI had him under investigation for it. I mean, that's what they were hoping for. So it's obvious why he told the lie. And in the abstract, it's obvious why the lie is important. The problem is that, it's twofold. Number one, the FBI knew exactly who he was, and they decided to accept the cover story, at least at the headquarters level, without asking him a lot of questions. And then the second thing, which is a position you don't want to be as the government in a false statements case, is Sussman can now look at the jury in summations and say, Michael Sussman is not the guy who lied to the investigating FBI agents in this case. That was their headquarters who lied to them about where the information was coming from. And that is not a good position to be in. So even if, you know, you could say in the abstract that what Sussman said to them was obviously a material lie, the way the case plays out in a jury trial is that it looks like the FBI is just as guilty as the defendant is.
So that was the second point I was going to underline. So the scandal here, as it's emerged, is less Sussman's cover story than the fact that the FBI was willing to proceed and did proceed despite knowing that the cover story was bogus and the source of the information.
Yeah. And, you know, I think at this point, Rich, this is not a one-off, right? This is something that we've been following with this crowd that was running the FBI going back to the Hillary Clinton emails investigation. You know, they're always doing something that's too clever by half. So, you know, Sussman comes in and does a little dance with them. And don't think that he didn't come in and give them this cover story, sort of nod, nod, wink, wink, as if he didn't know who he was dealing with. I mean, he's the one who chose. He didn't go, as we've said, he didn't report this in through normal channels. He targeted Baker as the person that he wanted to give this information to. And Sussman's not an idiot. He did that for a reason. And I think we're seeing the reason that, you know, what he basically understood was that FBI headquarters, while they want to be perceived as having nothing to do with politics and playing it strictly by the book, was very political. And they tried to do this. They tried basically to take political information and allow it to be brought into the system in a way that could hurt Trump if it turned out to be true, but they knew they were acting in a political context, but they tried to shape it in a way that they could deny that they had acted politically. Mm-hmm. This is not the first time we're seeing that with this crowd. They did that again and again and again.
Yeah. So we've hit on materiality. So there are two things hurdles that Durham needs to clear, right? Materiality, which you talked about, and falsity. And also the falsity element of the case was rendered a blow by the exclusion of this key text.
Yeah, so the text is not exactly excluded, but what happened yesterday, Rich, was we're recording on early Friday afternoon. The jury was charged Thursday. And when they were haggling, there's always haggling that goes on between the parties and the court over the jury instructions are going to be. So one of the big arguments that came up in the argument over the jury instructions was the defense made the very strong argument that the jury could not find Sussman guilty on the basis of the text alone. And just to remind people, the night before the meeting between Sussman and Baker, to get the meeting, Sussman sends Baker a text where he says, you know, Jim, this is Michael Sussman. I have something sensitive to discuss. Do you have time? I'm coming on my own, not representing a client, just want to help the Bureau. So that's close to a quote of what he says. The text is very damning because the lie that's alleged in the indictment is that he claimed, Sussman did, that he wasn't representing anyone when in fact he was representing the Clinton campaign and also this tech executive, Rodney Jaffe, who compiled the materials that he brought to Baker. So I've referred to the text as a smoking gun because it's like a flat statement from Sussman. It doesn't rely on Baker's recollection in order to prove that he lied. It's right there in black and white, and it's a statement that was made by Sussman himself. The problem for Durham is twofold. One is he didn't have this text at the time that he indicted the case. We talked a little bit about this last week. It turned out that he was preparing Baker in March of this year, just a couple of months ago, to testify in the trial. And during the preparation, Durham himself said to Baker, you know, look, we need anything you have in your personal records that might be relevant to this case, because we'd obviously have an obligation to turn that over to the defense. And that caused Baker, according to Baker, to check his his text, save text messages in the cloud. And that's when he found text messages with Sussman, including this one. So that's how he got the text. And he didn't have it in September when he indicted the case. Problem two for Durham is that in September, when he indicted the case, he was flush up against the statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. That is, this conversation happened on September 19th, 2016, which means Durham had to indict it by September 19th of 2021, or he was going to lose it. And what that means is, once he indicted it, in a normal case, Rich, if you indict comfortably within the statute of limitations and you get new criminal information, you just go back into the grand jury, you supersede the indictment, you add charges, you add, you know, description, what have you. But in this case, because he did it right flush at the end of the statute of limitations, he couldn't go back to the grand jury and add a new charge or even materially change the indictment because he's time barred. It's, you know, once September 21st or September 19th of 2021 hit, he really couldn't change the charge anymore. So what Sussman argued in the charging conference was, because this text is not charged in the indictment and it's a separate incident from what is charged in the indictment, which is the meeting the day after the text on September 19th in Baker's office, what that meant was the jury can't convict him based on the text. They still have to convict him, if at all, based on a false statement that occurred at the meeting the following day. So it's not that the text can't be used. The text is evidence that when Baker testified that on September 19th, Sussman insisted that he was not representing a client, what Durham can argue is that that version of events is consistent with the text immediately before the meeting and then the statements that Baker made to other FBI officials immediately after the meeting. But in order to convict him, the jury has to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Sussman made the false statement at the meeting with Baker on the 19th. Mm-hmm. And that's the proper, that's, they can use the text as potential evidence of that, but they can't say that he's guilty of making a false statement because he made a false statement in the text.
So, not to put you on the spot, which is what everyone always says prior to putting someone on the spot, would you expect Sussman to get acquitted?
I do. Yeah, I think it might happen as early as today, too. The way this rapidly closed at the end, it looked like Sussman was going to testify. He said the night before he was due to make the decision, which was, Wednesday going into Thursday. He said he was going to testify. So they were planning to, you know, he would have been on the stand all day Thursday and part of Friday. And then the idea would have been the judge would have straightened the charge out with the jury, the instructions, and then you would have had summations Tuesday after the long weekend. But because everything just kind of fell apart Thursday, the judge charged the jury on Thursday and summations are going on as we speak. So the jury will retire to begin deliberations sometime this afternoon. And that, you know, it's only a one count indictment and it's the Friday before a long weekend. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's always possible that the jury says, well, you know, we're tired, we'll come back on Tuesday. But they might also say, you know, we can get this done today and then we never have to come back again. And Friday is a usual day for juries to come in when they've been when they're out deliberating. I should mention here, Rich, this is just a little inside baseball thing, but it bothers me, so I feel like I should mention it. I hate this system of charging the jury before the lawyers sum up. Mm-hmm. When I was a prosecutor, the general practice in federal court was you had your jury conference, your jury instruction conference. We call it the charging conference because it's what the judge does is charge the jury as to what the law is. So you would have your charging conference before summations. And that way, everybody knew when they made their arguments to the jury what the judge was going to tell the jury about what the law applicable to the case was. And then after summations were over, the judge would then give the full jury charge, you know, the instructions to the jury, and then they would retire to deliberate. The system that Judge Cooper uses, which I've also seen in a number of state cases that we've talked about over the last year, is that you charge the jury, you have your charging conference, and then you give the jury the instructions on the law before the lawyers get up and make their arguments. And then the judge says a couple of things more to the jury, but then he basically just sends them out to deliberate. I've never liked that, because a lot of times in summations, especially in criminal cases, but it happens in civil cases too, lawyers say things that are just not true in their summations, especially when they're talking about propositions of law. And I always thought it was better to have the judge clean that up with the jury charge after the summations were over. I think you just invite problems by having the judge, and by the time the jury deliberates, they don't remember what the law is anymore that the judge told them. He may be giving them a copy of the instructions to take into the jury room. I don't know if he'll do that or not. I just don't like the way they're doing it, but that's a quibble on my part.
So just final question on this. So let's assume, for the sake of argument, Sussman gets acquitted. Will the blow, which we've discussed before, to Durham's investigation have been worth kind of additional information that's been added to fill out the picture here? Or would Durham presumably have had, you know, had all that information and could have included it in a final report without going through the risk of this trial?
Rich, the further we get into the trial, the more I can't understand why Durham brought this case. And mainly it's because of what we just discussed a couple of minutes ago, which is I don't see how he thought he had proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the statement before he had the text. And that's because, as we've discussed, I didn't flush this out as much today as I did last week, but this is a meeting that occurs between Baker and Sussman, 5 years ago for 20 minutes. It's a one-on-one meeting. No one is recording it. No one's taking notes. It's not the normal FBI witness interview where a witness is interviewed by two agents. One is the main questioner and the other one is taking notes. And, you know, they put together fairly promptly an accurate summary version of what the witness said. And there's two FBI agents available to testify if the witness ever disputes that he said what the Bureau says he said. Even that, as we've discussed before, is not a perfect system, but it's a lot better than what happened here. In this case, you not only had a short meeting 5 years ago that nobody had notes of that were contemporaneous and that isn't recorded, but also Baker has been interviewed by a couple of congressional committees and a couple of internal Justice Department investigations, and he's been all over the map about what Sussman told him regarding who he was representing, even using the word clients a couple of times. So, you know, I don't know why Durham thought that he had enough evidence to prove the statement. And in a false statements case, before you even get to falsity and materiality, you have to prove the statement. You have to prove what was said. And you don't have to prove it necessarily verbatim, word for word, but you have to have a reasonably accurate conveyance of what the substance of what was discussed was. And I'm just very surprised he thought he had that. I understand the frustration of being right up against you hate this as a prosecutor, but he's right up against the statute of limitations, and he's got, it's do or die, because if you don't do it by the day, in, you know, the statute runs, then you lose the count. And I'm sure as a prosecutor, he was absolutely to his bones, completely convinced that Sussman lied. And I think Sussman did lie. There's a good reason for Durham to have been convinced of that. But what you know and what you can prove are often two different things. And I'm just really surprised, especially with everything riding on his investigation and his final report, that he would take a chance like this with a case like this, because I don't think it really, I mean, I don't like seeing anybody get away with lying to the FBI, although with this FBI, it was like they were asking for it. But I just wonder if it was worth it taking this chance, given everything that rides on it.
So let's move on to this horrific school massacre in Texas. A lot of debate, obviously, about this. Once again, it starts immediately. You have the left saying, well, damn it, we know what to do, and you're just cowards, which is preventing you from doing it. And then we argue correctly, well, actually, you don't have a solution to this, and most everything that you're talking about would have nothing to do with preventing such shootings. You know, the shooters always pass the background checks. They haven't committed crimes. If they, you know, if you banned assault weapons, which isn't going to happen, you know, you could still do a lot of mayhem with any other sort of semi-automatic weapon. So what are your big takeaways from this one, Andy?
Well, I really like our editorial on it today. I wish I could take credit for it, but it's really, I think it really lays out exactly what the situation is with all this, which is that this is a very, very difficult problem that can't be solved. And it can only be managed and contained. And we could probably do a lot better job of managing it. But we're in a country of 330 million people with thousands of school districts. And, you know, if you think about it, from like the 20,000 foot level, this doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, it's horrific. And it's like one of these things, Rich, where every time it happens, you're always able to look at the you know, the sad sack who carried it out and, you know, in hindsight, say there were, you know, 20 different signs that that this guy was just a time bomb waiting to happen. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are time bombs waiting to happen who never go off. And it's not an exact science to figure out who is and is not going to be a mass murderer. As you just said, you know, with respect to all of the laws that we currently have on the books, most of them, in most of these incidents, some of these laws end up getting violated anyway. It doesn't stop people from doing what they do. And in a lot of situations, the laws in questions wouldn't have prevented the act that we're talking about. So I just think it's unfortunate that every time we get to this impasse, which happens every time that not only that there's a horrific mass shooting like this one, but even a big terrorist attack, there's always this big impulse in Washington to do something, especially from people who are, you know, have a political agenda, in this instance about guns. But a lot, what they do, if it was an obvious answer of what to do, that was a legal constitutional answer, we'd have done it already. And the reason we haven't is there's no silver bullet answer to this. And the proposals that the Democrats in particular are trying to make about it are unpopular. If they were popular, they would have enacted them already. They would have had support for them. They have, you know, the Democrats control both houses of Congress and the White House. And, you know, they're ranting and raving now, but they haven't been trying to move major gun legislation through Congress. And the reason is it's not popular. So, you know, we're dealing with a situation where you have profound issues of mental health that a lot of the people in Washington don't really want to deal with. We have a lot of laws that are, I almost want to think of them as shadow boxing, like they're showing some activity, but they're not really of any substantive value. And you have a fundamental right of self-defense that's vouchsafed by the Constitution, and that with respect to 99%+ of people who own firearms, those people are law-abiding people as to whom there's no problem with having firearms. And the other thing, I guess, that hits me over the head, Rich, and this is probably because I was a federal prosecutor in Manhattan for about 13, 14 years before they asked me to take over the satellite U.S. Attorney's Office north of the Bronx, the six counties on three on either side of the Hudson River, just north of the Bronx. And I'll tell you what, when you, the satellite office was in White Plains, which was like the southernmost part of it. But when you get even just 30 miles north of the Bronx, people's attitudes about firearms are very different from what they are in New York City. I heard Karl Rove talking about this yesterday because he was on Fox in a segment before I was. And Karl was saying that, you know, down in Uvalde, the people's attitudes and the culture with respect to guns is very different from what you get in New York or San Francisco or Chicago. And I'm thinking, as he was saying that, that when I was in New York itself, things were very different 30 miles north of the Bronx and 30 miles south of the Bronx. You know, I think the idea that there's like one Washington, one size fits all solution to what we're dealing with when we're dealing with a country that's culturally very complicated and very different and has very different attitudes about firearms than they do in Washington and New York. I don't see how you accomplish anything with the theater that we have in Washington every single time something like this happens. And I think, you know, for what it's worth, the Democrats might notice that the polls say that they're, you know, they're cruising for a tough time in November. And I think there's a reason for that.
Yeah. So how do you feel that that editorial endorsed a couple things at the state level? One is states going up to 21 years old to buy a rifle. There's a federal rule, you can't buy a handgun unless you're 21. And this seems to be a little bit of a vestige of a prior era where, you know, you got out from school and you got your hunting rifle and went, you know, bagged a deer for your family's meals for a couple of weeks. And the red flag laws, which are controversial within conservatism. We had a big argument about it on the editors today when we recorded it. So where are you on upping the age limit and looking at red flag laws?
I don't have a problem with upping the age limit as long as it's not a federal requirement. I really do believe in federalism on guns because I've seen personally, as I just tried to explain, that it's that it, yeah, you know, it's just different from place to place. But I don't have a problem with it if it's a normal legislative exercise where they actually, you know, roll up their sleeves and do some work. And if it turns out that, you know, we would improve safety in some meaningful way by raising the age to 21, I don't have a problem with that. And I don't have a visceral opposition to red flag laws as many conservatives do. I've heard all the slippery slope arguments where I come from, and I think this is rich from being in the law for my adult life more than coming up in journalism, maybe. But, you know, no constitutional right is absolute. And I find that, like, I've had to make this argument in the context of any number of our fundamental rights. You know, every single one of them, is the reason it's fundamental is because it's so important. But our rights don't exist in a vacuum. They are in tension with each other. They have to compete with each other. They have to make accommodations for each other. Liberty, which is our most basic right next to life, is something that I spent my whole career proving that you can have restrictions on. You know, I mean, if you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody committed a crime, you take their liberty away. So the idea that you can do that, but you can't restrict people's gun ownership, to me is absurd. So I have no problem with red flag laws. I have a problem with red flag laws from Washington. But I think on a local level, balancing what the principles and values of particular communities are and having them make sensible accommodations on and sensible restrictions on gun ownership, I don't have a problem with that. Where I have a problem, Rich, doesn't have to do with red flag laws per se, My problem is, and this, I'm going to sound like a broken record on this because we speak about it in so many different contexts, but my problem is that Democrats in particular in Washington weaponize law enforcement as a political weapon against their opposition. And I think people see a two-tier justice system, and they see that, like, with when you have people who are different ideological or partisan bent commit virtually the same conduct and be treated 180 degrees different from situation to situation, I think that you then develop a reputation in your law that you are not to be trusted to administer it fairly and administer it equally across the board. And the reason I think you're not going to find people tripping over themselves, even if you could come up, I believe I could design, Rich, a reasonable due process compliant system for a state for red flag laws. We mentioned in our editorial today that Florida, for example, has had some pretty good success with theirs, which I think reading the report we linked, it's been invoked about 6,000 times, which is, you know, for a state of that size is probably about right. So I think this can be done. I think there can be appropriate due process protections. I'd be concerned about making sure people had access to counsel and the like. But my biggest problem with it, especially if it comes from Washington, is I don't believe it'll be administered in good faith. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people will be punished. What I've seen it happen too many times. I think if you're a pro-Trump person or a Republican person, you're going to be treated one way by a Democratic administration. And if you're a progressive, you're going to be treated a different way. And that's not right. And as long as our law has a reputation for that, then we're not going to be able to do sensible things because the people can't be trusted to administer the laws fairly.
Yeah. And then where are you on the question? We've heard a lot from Republicans on this, and the left has poured scorn on it. But the idea of doing more to kind of harden school buildings and or add more armed guards.
Well, I mean, how could you not be for that? What I was agog about, and you probably know more about this than I do, but I couldn't believe in our editorial today how much money is slushing around in these schools and how little of it would take to divert to security to make things meaningfully better than they are now. I just found that stunning.
Yeah, it's the helicopter drop that happened all around the land with these COVID relief funds is just extraordinary. So that's all the time we have this week. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks everyone for listening, and thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.